What if democracy is bunk? What if you were only allowed to vote because it didn't make any difference? What if no matter how you voted, the elites got to have it their way? What if one person, one vote was just a fiction created by the government to induce your compliance? What if democracy was dangerous to personal freedom? What if democracy eroded the people's understanding of natural rights and the foundations of government and instead turned government into a beauty contest? What if democracy allowed the government to do anything it wants, as long as more people bother to show up voting in favor of it than those who showed up voting to say no? What if the purpose of democracy was to convince people that they could prosper not through the creation of wealth, but through theft from others? What if the only moral way to acquire economic wealth is through real economic activity? What if the government persuaded you that you could acquire wealth through political activity? What if economic activity included all the productive and peaceful things we did? What if political activity included all the parasitical and destructive things the government does? What if governments were originally established to protect people's freedom, but always turned into political and imperialist enterprises that sought to expand their power, increase their territory, and heighten their control over the population? What if the idea that we need a government to take care of us is actually a fiction? What if our strength as individuals and our durability as a culture are contingent not on the strength of the government, but on the amount of freedom we have from the government? What if we're seeing civil unrest around the world precisely because the government is in control and out of control? What if this held true even among those protesters whose grievances involve demanding more from government? What if that's what the cocktail of big government and democracy produces? What if so-called democratic government, once it grows to a certain size, begins to soften and weaken the people? What if big government destroys people's motivations and democracy convinces them that the only motivation they need is to vote and go along with what the vote results are? What if the Republican primary we're seeing unfold isn't actually as democratic as it may appear to be? What if the results you saw from the states voting last Tuesday won't match the composition of the delegates they send to the Tampa convention this summer because the polls aren't what count, but what counts are the secret meetings that come after the voting? What if that monster Joe Stalin was right when he said the most powerful person in the world is the guy who gets to count the votes? What if that's how we lost our republic? What if the problem with democracy is that the majority thinks it can do and regulate and acquire anything it wants? What if the greatest tyrant in history lives among us? What if that tyrant gets its way all the time, no matter what the laws are or what the Constitution says? What if that tyrant is the majority of voters? What if the majority in a democracy recognized no limits on its power? What if the government misinformed voters to justify anything the government wants to do? What if the government bribed people with the money it prints? What if it gave entitlements to the poor and tax breaks to the middle class and bailouts to the rich just to keep us all dependent on it? What if a vibrant republic requires not just the democratic process of voting, but also informed and engaged voters who understand first principles of government and the divine origin of natural rights? What if we can free ourselves from the yoke of big government through a campaign of education and information that leads to a return to first principles? What if the establishment doesn't want this? What if the government remains the same no matter who wins elections? What if, because of Ron Paul's campaign, freedom will win because he isn't just campaigning for votes, but for educating the population and winning the hearts and minds of a once free people, inspiring them to fight for their freedom once again? What if we can be free? What will it take to make that happen? File this one under Do As I Say, Not As I Do. An investigation by Channel 4 in Nashville, Tennessee, revealed the police found marijuana in the home of a woman named Danielle Elks. Mrs. Elks is the director of the state's Alcoholic Beverage Commission, known as the ABC, whose mission is to eradicate marijuana in the state of Tennessee. Police only discovered the drugs because they found the front door to her home open and suspected a burglary, so they just walked in. Normally, if the cops find drugs in someone's home, that person will be charged and likely prosecuted, but not Mrs. Elks. Channel 4 spoke with an ABC employee who told the news station that if drugs were found in an average citizen's home, even under terrible circumstances like this where the door was open, it would still be investigated. Danielle Elk's got a pass, apparently, because she's a high-ranking government official. But we should all get the pass. The Constitution simply does not allow the police to search your home without probable cause, even if the front door is open, period. And we all have the natural right to put into our bodies whatever we want, period. The war on drugs ensnared a 45-year-old Mississippi grandmother who now faces a year in jail for, are you ready for this, purchasing a $9 box of Sudafed and bringing it across state lines. Mrs. Diane Avera purchased the nasal decongestant in Demopolis, Alabama. She says it was for a scuba diving expedition in Panama City. Sudafed helps with ear trouble while scuba diving. It is also a common ingredient used in the manufacture of illegal methamphetamine, which is why Mississippi requires a prescription for this common decongestant. The clerk at her local Walmart told her to go to Alabama, where cough medicine is legal to purchase over the counter. Unfortunately for Mrs. Avera, police were conducting a sting in Demopolis, Alabama, and Mrs. Avera was arrested by a police officer outside the Walmart where she purchased the perfectly lawful Sudafed. The director of the Mississippi Bureau of Narcotics, Marshall Fisher, said about the anti-decongestant laws in his own state, quote, "We have enough to say grace over without doing that silliness. The last thing we want to be responsible for is targeting grandma." Yet Mrs. Avery, a grandmother who has never run afoul of the law, is now facing a year in jail. This is more than silliness. 16 states currently allow pot for medicinal uses, and now it looks like marijuana for recreational use could be right around the corner. The state of Washington may vote to allow pot to be regulated similarly to alcohol, so the sale of pot would be restricted to the 21 and over crowd. Colorado could legalize pot to the point where it's treated like, quote, grapes, tomatoes, or other harmless botanical plants. Is all this moving too fast, or is the time right? Ethan Nadelman, good friend of the show from the Drug Policy Alliance, joins us now. Ethan, it's a pleasure. Welcome back to Freedom Watch.
Thanks for having me on, Judge.
So tell me how this would work in California. How would marijuana be regulated like wine?
Well, the basic idea is to say to the legislature, you guys come up with the rules and regulations, but basically aim for a model like wine. Now, obviously, when it comes to production, a lot of people like the idea of marijuana being grown like, to say, wine is produced in vineyards,
right,
you know, rather than having a kind of Budweiser model. On the other hand, when it comes to the retail sale and when it comes especially to use, probably the rules that are going to apply are more like the smoking rules. There's going to be bans on smoking in public, bans on smoking in bars and all sorts of other places like that. So it'll be something like a wine model. But look, Washington State's a little like an alcohol model. Colorado, which is going to be on the ballot, is going to be something like an alcohol model.
Right.
So people are aiming for that basic idea.
All right, Ethan, what about the 800-pound gorilla, which is the federal government? Because marijuana, the feds claim, is still against federal law, and they claim that they can selectively prosecute distributors and users. How do you get around that?
Well, it's going to be very tough, Judge. It's a lot like the repeal of alcohol prohibition. You know, when Congress finally, you know, repealed the Volstead Act and we passed the 21st Amendment in 1933 repealing alcohol prohibition, it didn't start at the federal level. It started with the states beginning to repeal their own state prohibition laws. So the only way we're going to see marijuana get legally regulated around the country is for the states to take the lead, create those conflicts with the feds, push them back. What we've been very careful to do in drafting these initiatives,
right,
is to try to protect medical marijuana so that if marijuana gets legalized for everybody and the feds come flying in and try to block it, at least the medical marijuana portion will be preserved.
All right. Is this in any way going to be impacted by the presidential race? Because I do know of one Republican seeking his party's nomination who openly and notoriously says what you put into your own body is none of the government's business.
You know, the only impact, look, Obama's not going to talk about this. And if the Republican candidate is Romney or any of the other leaders right now, they're not talking about this as well, except to say that they're against it. Because even though 50% of Americans now say they support legalizing marijuana use, first time we've ever seen a majority, the presidential candidates still see this as the third wheel of American politics. On the other hand, what we may well see is that the Libertarian candidate, whether that's Gary Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, who sort of got pushed out of the Republican primaries, or whether it's Ron Paul, I think running independently in some way, I think you're going to see more young people showing up at the polls and more people voting for the Libertarian line than ever before.
when we were colonists and fought a war against the king and the parliament so that we could secede from the British Empire and be independent of it, we also fought for the values of personal freedom. That is the idea that in matters of personal choice, the government should play no role. The king didn't care very much about the colonists' personal choices, so long as he could control them and tax them. One of the taxes he imposed was to support the Church of England. The Church of England that the colonist tax was supporting was, of course, in England. It was not here. So among the hateful taxes that impelled the colonists to revolt was this tax to support the king's church. When the Constitution was written, religious freedom was a principal matter for discussion and debate among the framers. They addressed this in the first clause of the First Amendment. Before the Constitution even protects the freedom of speech, it protects the natural right to worship or not to worship, free from the government. Here's what it says, quote, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." That is very direct and very clear. It was intended to prevent any tax money from going to a church, and it was intended to keep the government from using its coercive powers to influence or to punish religious institutions. For 125 years, most governments in America left our churches and religious institutions alone. Then along came the progressive attitude that some ethnic groups are better than others. This is a damnable and racist view that was put upon the federal government by Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson in direct response to the influx of Southern European immigrants at the beginning of the last century, most of whom were Roman Catholic. Wilson and Roosevelt and their progressive followers thought these immigrants had too many children, children who would grow up to be voters and vote out their nanny state central planning government. So they began to encourage birth control and sterilizations and even abortions. The Catholic Church resisted this by its teachings on birth control. The Church had made its teaching on contraception a core part of its mission for over 400 years. And Pope Paul VI reaffirmed these teachings in a permanent way in 1967. That the Church embraces these teachings is well known. And equally well known is the policy of the federal government to resist them. But that resistance reached unconstitutional proportions a few weeks ago when Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, herself a Roman Catholic, issued regulations that require all employers in America to make contraceptive materials and devices available to their employees. The all employers includes Catholic universities and Catholic hospitals and Catholic schools and Catholic churches themselves. And the failure to comply with this law will result in a fine to these institutions and the provision of contraceptive devices to their employees by the government itself. This is quite literally Congress making a law that interferes with the free exercise of religion. This is not about the morality of contraception. This is about the constitutionality of government coercion, coercion of religious institutions, coercion directly and profoundly prohibited by the Constitution itself. The motivation for the coercion, that Catholics have too many kids, is reprehensible. And those in government who embrace that and who are willing to use the power of government to promulgate that should be voted out of office. But the coercion is the same as that faced by the folks who seceded from the king because of his tax to pay for a church to which they did not choose to belong. America, we have a king again today, and he wants a tax to pay for his church. The king is the president, and the church is called Obamacare. Don't let this happen. This is not just a Catholic issue. This is an issue about whether the Constitution means what it says. Does the Constitution let the government compel Jews to eat pork, or Protestants to genuflect, or Muslims to own dogs, or Catholics to pay for contraception? The answer is obvious. South Carolina Republican Senator Jim DeMint stated that a debate within the Republican Party between traditionalists, who are conservatives who want to use the government to make their values the law of the land, and libertarians, who are conservatives who want the government out of the way so people can choose their own values, is a good debate and one worth having. Then he added that a debate within the Republican Party with those who want to grow the government is not a debate worth having. because we cannot financially afford or constitutionally tolerate any more growth in government. I think Senator DeMint is onto something here. We're at a crossroads in our history. Most of us are sick and tired of too much government. And we must reject those Republicans who preach small government, but when they are elected, just expand the government into their version of big government. That's what George W. Bush did. He fought two wars on a credit card. He had the feds take over education and prescription drugs for seniors. He added $2 trillion to the government's debt. He assaulted the Constitution by letting federal agents write their own search warrants. And he borrowed money from the Chinese and gave it to Wall Street in TARP and other failed stimulus programs. And by doing this, and doing it while claiming to be a conservative Republican, he destroyed the meaning of that term. There is nothing conservative about the manner in which he governed. But there is something establishment about it. The word establishment gets used quite often these days on conservative talk radio and cable TV. And many people wonder, what is the establishment? Who are these people? Are they the elites and the patricians? And if so, what does that make the rest of us? The establishment is another word for the big government Republicans. That would be the same folks who brought us all the government growth and debt and loss of freedom during the Bush presidency. Here's an example. When Ronald Reagan ran in the GOP primaries against President Ford in 1976, the establishment opposed him and Reagan lost. When Ronald Reagan ran in the GOP primaries against George H.W. Bush in 1980, the establishment opposed him and Reagan won. You see, the establishment always sides with the candidate who is least likely to rock the boat and most likely to keep them, the establishment, in power. The establishment candidate this year is Mitt Romney. He's the big government guy. He likes government and wants to expand it under the guise of improving it. Enter Congressman Ron Paul. He's the only Republican candidate for president who truly will shrink the government. He's the only Republican candidate who will keep the government from adding to its debt, keep your money from losing its value, keep our troops from fighting meaningless wars, and keep the government within the confines of the Constitution. He is also the only Republican candidate intellectually honest enough to defend his opponents when they are unjustly attacked. Case in point. Before the big government, Mitt Romney was a politician. He was a very successful businessman. He and his partners bought and sold businesses, and they created wealth and jobs. In creating wealth, Romney made some businesses smaller, but more efficient. His new businesses made better products and made them less expensive than they had been before he bought and restructured those businesses. And for this, some Republicans like Newt Gingrich and Rick Perry have attacked him. Their attacks on Mitt Romney as a heartless vulture capitalist backfired when Congressman Ron Paul unexpectedly defended Governor Romney and schooled both Gingrich and Perry on the importance of choice in the free market. Governor Perry, unable to understand the difference between capitalism, which is the freedom to invest, purchase, and choose, and corporatism, which is government picking winners and losers in the marketplace, must have felt very strange trying to defend his remarks that made him and Newt Gingrich sound more like Occupy Wall Street socialists than free market sound money conservatives. But Governor Romney's monetary policies are not intended to grow the economy. He is no champion of free market capitalism because he believes that the banks are too big to fail and TARP and stimulus are the right things to do. Ron Paul's policies to audit the Federal Reserve and rein it in have put him on the map as the only man who can take on Mitt Romney from the right and unite social conservatives and Tea Partiers and libertarians, even civil liberty-loving Democrats and independents, to beat Barack Obama. Ron Paul has already demonstrated that he is the bridge between restoring trust from ordinary Americans and their government, so that we may once again have a government that will leave us alone. What if the whole purpose of the Constitution was to limit the government? What if Congress's enumerated powers in the Constitution no longer limited Congress, but were actually used as a justification to extend Congress's authority over every realm of human life? What if the president, meant to be an equal to Congress, has instead become a democratically elected, term-limited monarch? What if the president assumed that everything he did was legal just because he's the president? What if he could interrupt your regularly scheduled radio and TV programming for a special message from him? What if he could declare war on his own? What if he could read your emails and your texts without a search warrant? What if he could kill you without warning? What if Supreme Court justices no longer looked to the Constitution to determine the constitutionality of a law, but rather simply to what justices who preceded them thought about it? What if the rights and principles guaranteed in the Constitution have been so distorted in the past 200 years as to be unrecognizable by the founders? What if the 50 states were no longer sovereign entities, equals to each other, and parents of the federal government they voluntarily constituted? What if the states were mere provinces of a totally nationalized and fully centralized government? What if the Constitution was amended stealthily, not by constitutional amendments duly ratified by the states, but by the constant and persistent expansion of the federal government's role in our lives? What if the federal government decided if its own powers were proper and constitutional? What if the Constitution were no longer the supreme law of the land? What if you needed a license from the government to speak, to assemble, or to protest against the government? What if the government didn't like what you planned to say, and so it didn't give you the license? What if the right to keep and bear arms only applied to the government? What if posse comitatus, the federal law that prohibits our military from occupying our streets, were no longer in effect? What if the government considered the military an adequate dispenser of domestic law enforcement? What if cops looked and acted like troops and you couldn't distinguish the military from the police? What if you were not secure in your person, in your papers, and in your property? What if federal agents could write their own search warrants in defiance of the Constitution? What if the government could decide when you were and were not entitled to a jury trial? What if the government could take your property whenever it wanted? What if the government could continue prosecuting you until it got the verdict it wanted? What if the government could force you to testify against yourself simply by labeling you a domestic terrorist? What if the government could torture you until you said what the government wanted to hear? What if people running for president actually supported torture? What if the government tortured your children to get to you? What if government judges and government lawyers intimidated juries into convicting the innocent? What if the government could send you to your death and your innocence meant nothing so long as the government's procedures were followed? What if America's prison population, the largest in the world, was a cruel and unusual way for a country to be free? What if half the prison population never harmed anyone but themselves? What if the people had no rights except those the government chose to let them have? What if the states had no rights except to do as the federal government commanded? What if our elected officials didn't really live among us, but instead all had their hearts and homes in Washington, D.C.? What if the government could strip you of your rights because of where your mother was when you were born? What if the income tax was unconstitutional? What if the states were convinced to give up their representation in Congress? What if the government tried to ban you from using a substance in your body that is older than the government itself? What if voting didn't mean anything anymore because both political parties stand for big government? What if the government could write any law, regulate any behavior, and tax any event? The Constitution be damned. What if the government was the reason we don't have a Constitution anymore? What if you could love your country but hate what the government has done to it? What if sometimes, to love your country, you had to alter or abolish the government? What if Jefferson was right? What if that government is best which governs least? What if I'm right? What if the government is wrong? What if it is dangerous to be right when the government is wrong? What if it is better to perish fighting for freedom than to live as a slave? What if freedom's greatest hour of danger is now? What would it take for us to return to a gold standard? Well, believe it or not, the president could do this on his own, just as an American president ended the gold standard on his own. Of course, returning us to convertibility would arouse the wrath of the big government types and the central bankers, as they would lose their ability to manipulate our currency, to print cash at will, to control our behavior, and of course, to enrich themselves. Convertibility meant that anyone could bring U.S. dollars to the U.S. Treasury Department's gold window and receive gold, real gold, in return. This was a legal requirement respected by the government and honored by it until President Nixon, on his own in 1971, directed the Treasury to stop converting dollars into gold. This was the third and final nail in the coffin of the gold standard. The other two nails had been hammered by Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Lincoln instituted paper money during the Civil War and refused to deliver gold to those who demanded it. FDR unilaterally prohibited ownership of all gold other than jewelry by anyone except the government. Both of these decisions raised grave constitutional issues. In Lincoln's case, he defied the constitutional requirement of precious metals as the basis for currency. And in FDR's case, he defied the constitutional principle that the government only has the powers that the people have given to it, and the people never authorized the government to confiscate their gold. In both cases, the courts shirked their duties to uphold the Constitution and let those tyrannical presidents go about destroying liberty and prosperity. Do we have enough gold to return to convertibility? Well, the big government types who were whispering into President Nixon's ear persuaded him that there can be too much or too little of anything. Oh, but they forgot that the natural quality of money is scarcity, and because it is scarce, it has value. If this were not so, nothing would prevent us from just printing our way to prosperity. Of course, the Federal Reserve, to the contrary notwithstanding, if we printed an infinite amount of money, then the money would be worthless. That's why gold and silver are valuable and will be traded, despite all the heavy laws and thieving taxation that renders gold owners as outlaws in many ways. That's also why countries that have tried to print their way to prosperity have ended up with wheelbarrows of cash needed to buy a loaf of bread. If government stopped taxing gold and silver as if they were a toothbrush or a car, gold and silver would circulate as currency once again. That way, gold or silver or both could make their way into the hands of the poor and the middle class. This is truly a free market way to spread the wealth. If we abolished legal tender laws, those laws which permit the government to print worthless paper money, that would be a step on the road toward freedom and prosperity. If the Federal Reserve no longer held a monopoly on the money supply, then finally banks would be free from the crippling burdens of regulation by Washington and fixed interest rates determined by bureaucrats. Then we would see real competition among the banks for your business. Banks would only lend money that they had on deposit. Abolishing legal tender laws means that a private bank can mint a coin and create a banknote similar to how the Fed does it. Only this time it would be backed by gold. Even digital currencies could be created, as we could trade online goods and services for digital coins that have value to those who decide to trade in them. Think of it. We could have a new economy, no longer weighed down by the ancient institutions in Washington and regulated only by fair competition, the laws of supply and demand, and a government that protected us only from force and from fraud. Finally, when gold and silver become currencies again, as the Constitution clearly requires, when government-issued paper money is abolished, we can begin to clean up the mess that has become the American banking system. Banks, for example, will no longer be required to have FDIC insurance and all the costs and regulations that accompany it. Think about it. The federal government has no business insuring your money in somebody else's bank. Instead, private insurance companies would come in and insure that money. Liberty means opportunity for more private enterprise and a government that does less, regulates less, and extracts less from taxpayers. When all this happens, then we will see the opposite of what has happened when the Feds devalued the dollar by separating it from gold. A gold-backed currency, as I write in my book, It is Dangerous to be Right When the Government is Wrong, will chase the worthless currency from the marketplace. Stated differently, it would be the free market's way of driving the money changers from the temple and the constitutional way of ridding ourselves of the chains the government and its bankers have shackled upon us. In March of 1933, when FDR had been in office for just 2 weeks, he signed an executive order prohibiting all persons in America from owning gold. He also directed that those who continued to own gold, other than in jewelry, be incarcerated and fined. He claimed the authority to do this because he claimed it was necessary to save the American economy, then in the throes of a Federal Reserve-generated depression. This would, of course, become the Great Depression, in large measure because virtually everything FDR and the Congress did to address it in the next 12 years actually made it worse. FDR's order prohibiting ownership of gold was even worse than it appeared to be. FDR's advisors told him that gold would fetch about $35 an ounce in the open market. So he signed a second executive order directing that all Americans sell their gold to the United States Treasury for $25 an ounce so that the Treasury could resell it to foreign banks for $35 an ounce and collect a quick and enormous profit. After the same advisors reminded FDR that under the Constitution only Congress can write the laws, he relented. But he angrily denounced the Constitution as born in the, quote, horse and buggy era, and that he asked for and received legislation from Congress that mirrored his executive orders, and he signed that legislation into law. Then the Treasury began to force people to sell their gold. It would be another 40 years before Americans would legally be able to own gold. Now, I recount this sordid tale because it is a paradigm of government today where both Congress and the President use the powers of government that we have given to them to do things to us that we have never authorized them to do. In FDR's case, his behavior was not only unconstitutional, since only Congress can write the laws, it was also criminal, since it constituted theft. And FDR's language, of course, was reprehensible. He mocked the very document, the Constitution, which he had just 2 weeks earlier sworn to uphold, protect, and defend. Of course, FDR did many other things to the Constitution, including threatening to neutralize the votes of Supreme Court justices with whom he disagreed and refusing to defend Pearl Harbor when he knew what was coming. And that made him one of history's great monsters. But it is his cavalier willingness to reject the basic structure of the Constitution that enables us to draw comparisons to our present-day ills. President Obama's favorite hero among his predecessors is FDR. Though he, too, took an oath to uphold the Constitution, he, too, has directly assaulted it. He has killed at least two Americans, one a Muslim cleric because he felt the evidence of the cleric's guilt in encouraging others to violence was overwhelming and the danger of more harm was imminent. The other was the cleric's 16-year-old son, about whom he has claimed to have no evidence of guilt of anything. He did this even though the Constitution he swore to uphold says that, quote, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. He started a war without the approval of Congress, even though the Constitution says only Congress can start wars. His Justice Department now wants to prosecute you for fibbing about your age or your weight on the Internet, at the same time that the Justice Department wants legal permission to lie to you and to federal judges about whether documents you seek from the government truly exist. His Department of Agriculture tried to impose a tax on the sale of every Christmas tree, even though the Constitution makes it clear that only Congress can impose taxes. I think you get the picture here. When presidents violate the Constitution, the supreme and fundamental law of the land, and when they get away with it, that establishes a very dangerous precedent for future presidents to exceed their predecessors' behavior. That's the basis for my argument that without the Patriot Act, which sacrifices personal liberty for a false sense of safety, there would have been no Obamacare, which sacrifices personal choices for a false collective good. Do you remember this past summer's debt debate debacle? It ended with the super committee, which ended in failure, which resulted in no cuts in government spending. Do you remember the summer before that when Tea Party protesters came out in full force against Obamacare and members of Congress who were contemplating supporting it? Do you remember when the Tea Party caused the Republicans to become the majority in the House of Representatives and even replaced a few prominent liberal Republicans in the Senate with small government conservatives? Where's all the raucous protest? Where was it when those who were elected to Congress in 2010 on the promise of reining in spending so spectacularly and clearly failed to do just that? Oh, it seems everybody wants something for nothing, and everybody wants something from the government. Frankly, this is why Ron Paul has never been the flavor of the week. He is the only serious Republican candidate who actually is advocating real austerity, real spending cuts, and a real shrinking of government. Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney don't want to shrink the government because they love government. They just want to manage it better. But the problem with that approach, of course, is that government by its very nature is always mismanaged. The centralization of decision-making amplifies poor decisions while disincentivizing prudent ones. Unlike an individual or a well-run corporation, government is not motivated by how efficient it can be, but rather by how lucrative it can be for those associated with it and how those who run the government can stay in power. Someone who is philosophically opposed to government domination of the housing market would not perpetuate it by taking one red cent of taxpayer money from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac like the former speaker did, whether he calls himself a historian or a lobbyist. Someone philosophically opposed to government domination of the healthcare market would never offer up government as the solution to the problem of the uninsured like the former governor of Massachusetts did, since the problem of the uninsured was created by government's involvement in the healthcare market in the first place. The federal government does not need an efficient manager. That's a pipe dream based on the noble but flawed premise that government can be made to operate as a business. It cannot. Business is subject to the forces of free choices, supply and demand, and competition. Can you imagine the government subjecting itself to the forces of competition? Can you imagine the government permitting us to ignore it? The government's biggest sacred cow is, of course, the Pentagon. The mere thought of reductions in the growth of defense spending have the Washington careerists screaming bloody murder. Yet military expert after military expert, not connected to the Pentagon and not employed in the defense industry, has told us over and over again that austerity will force the government to do what Congress lacks the political courage to do. Stated differently, we will keep spending on bases we don't need, on planes that sit unused in hangars, and on military hardware stored all over the world, not for any national security interest, but simply because a congressman has earmarked it. We will do this unless we get serious about our future. A dollar of military spending is not a dollar of military strength, but it is a dollar into the coffers of those who contribute to congressional campaigns. Think about it. Which is the greater threat to our national security? An impoverished gaggle of third world revolutionaries 10,000 miles away, or our own national debt? The answer, America, is obvious. Government is not a jobs program, and government is not your caretaker. Government is an arrangement made by free individuals to protect their rights and their property. It doesn't take $3.6 trillion a year to do that effectively in America today. I doubt it even takes a trillion. But we must swallow the bitter pill of austerity now on our own terms, while we are still the undisputed leader of the free world and while we still have a constitution, so that we can restore our prosperity consistent with personal liberty. It is a far better option than waiting for the bitter pill of austerity to be forced upon us when our country has become a shell of the proud and prosperous nation it once was. Our cousins in Europe are learning that the hard way, even as we marvel at their sudden but inexorable demise. In America, the government seems to control everything. Light bulbs, shoe leather, refrigerators, the water strength of your shower, your banker, your doctor, your lawyer. All are regulated by the feds beyond belief. What is it in America that the feds cannot control? The answer is simple. Human nature. We need to eat and we need to move about. And that means we will use the free market with or without the government in order to do so. Every capable human on the planet engages in market exchanges, even in those countries where it's illegal. And through all of known history, humans have advanced civilization by building up the avenues of trade so as to increase their standards of living. When you buy a loaf of bread or a gallon of gas, you are freely choosing to engage in what remains of the free market. I emphasize the phrase "what remains" because when you buy bread, you are paying the local or state government a tax for a product that was baked under conditions set forth by the feds and one of the 50 states. And when you buy fuel for your car, up to one quarter of the cost of the fuel consists of state and federal sales taxes. You know this. I believe that sales taxes constitute a grand theft concocted by politicians and bureaucrats so as to provide them with a never-ending supply of your cash, which they can use to bribe people for their votes. Sales taxes also make items that we need more expensive, and they intrude on your privacy. Think about it. If I want a loaf of bread and you are a grocer willing to sell me one, what business is that of the government? None. What involvement has the government had in that transaction? None. What has the government done to add value to that transaction? Nothing. The protesters in Wall Street seem not to understand that free trade is a natural right like speech, travel, religion, self-defense, privacy, and is mutually beneficial to both the buyer and the seller. That's why at the end of the transaction, each party says, thank you, because we have both benefited. It is a win-win. I have food and fuel, and the seller of them has revenue. So how is it today that this natural and daily activity has become much maligned and exploited and even hated by the governing classes of the world? As the global economies have collapsed and collided in the past decade, nothing has been certain except for uncertainty. The world's central banks, drunk on power, loaded their people up with debt and then slowly guided their economies into destruction. That's the consequence of government control of the monetary system and the means of exchange. Prices in an economy are like traffic signals, signaling where goods and resources should go and how fast they should move. Central banks distort those traffic signals and even send the wrong signals. That's why we have crashes, because of government traffic signals, because the government has taken the free out of the free marketplaces. But free trade does occur in the United States in many ways. The black markets are where people trade for what they want for a price agreed upon, free of taxes, free of government regulations, and at prices that are acceptable to the parties. Simply banning the activity will not deter some portion of the population from attempting to acquire something, whether it's bread or tobacco or drugs or guns, that the government doesn't want you to have. People will always trade what they have for what they want or need. That's human nature. That's a natural human right. That cannot be stopped by the government. But of course, governments have tried to stop the exercise of this right. During World War II, for example, FDR and his cronies rationed sugar and leather and tea and tobacco and guns and coffee and fuel and many other items our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents needed for everyday use. The stated purpose of the rationing was that the troops needed these items, and there were not enough of them to go around, so the federal government would decide who got what and how much all these things would cost. But there was a black market in all these items, and there the items were plentiful, and the price was freely agreed upon. If the government had just stayed out of the picture, the market could have existed in the light of day. We now know that FDR was more interested in control than he was in supplying the troops. He knew there was enough to meet everyone's needs. To me, the heroes in those days were not those who counted their ration coupons. The heroes were those who bought and sold with impunity. The government fears trade, free trade, because it can't control it. The feds would do well to remember the lesson that where goods and services freely cross borders, don't freely cross borders, armies will. And where goods and services do freely cross borders, armies will not. What if a country that began with a free market has been transformed into a system of private ownership but government control? What if we went from an imperfect form of capitalism to an abominable form of corporatism? What if the government decided whom to enrich and whom to keep poor? What if individual economic interests didn't match the interests of the government? What if the government viewed a free market economy as a threat to its own interests? What if the government benefited most when it controlled the economy? What if we were living in an age of de Tocqueville's grim warning that a republic will crumble when the government learns to bribe the people with their own money? What if our economy were being suffocated not only by excess regulations, but also by an active attempt by the government to take over the economy, sector by sector? What if government bureaucrats grew stronger as the private sector grew weaker? What if the load-bearing walls of the entitlement state were buckling under the pressure of excess spending? What if the pillars of free enterprise were buckling under the pressure of excess taxation? What if the Occupy Wall Street protesters were being manipulated and pushed and prodded into expressing the basest feelings of greed, class envy, and jealousy? What if they were being infiltrated by agents of the government in order to drive demonstrators towards increasingly radical, anti-capitalist, and even violent rhetoric? What if the same government that was pretending to prosecute them really supported them? What if the government uses the angst these people have brought about to ratchet up the nationalization of our economy? What if the government could take any private property it wanted, so long as it paid a fair price? What if the government found ways to take any private property it wanted without paying any price? What if the government produced misleading reports so the economy appeared to grow when it really was shrinking? What if the government made the economy look good, like it was growing, by stealing money from people's earnings and savings just to fund more government spending? What if some of America's largest corporations were no longer profitable except when they received money from the government? What if government regulators were really bought and paid for, and the regulatory scheme was really a facade to empower the regulators and enrich the people being regulated? What if regulations never really even protected you? What if they always served to advance the interests of companies rich enough to capture regulators, but not innovative enough to compete in the free market? What if the centralization of power in the hands of government never served to protect the people? What if regulations stole freedom and simply made it easier for those who didn't want to compete in a free market to use government force to maintain their dominance? What if we didn't need the government in order to have a healthy economy? What if we could have an economy based on the free market, where the voluntary exchanges of goods and services drives all economic activity? What if we were free from government fiat and manipulation? What if free people could shun the government's economy in favor of a free market they cultivate outside the purview of government? What if our money had real value? What if the federal government decided what time of day it is? What if the federal government made it a law that you had to change every clock in your house whenever it told you to do so? What if the bureaucrats forced you to change your clock so that your children had to walk home from school in the dark? What if we were a nation of sheep who just accepted all this? What if Democrats weren't the only ones who thought they could manage the economy? What if Republicans claimed that they could manage it too? What if almost all Republicans and all Democrats really believed in big government? What if all the major Republican presidential candidates have indicated they believe that they can best manage the economy, except for one of them? What if that one says that if he were elected, he wouldn't manage the economy at all? He'd turn it over to the free choices of free people. What if the elites in banking and government and in both political parties feared this candidate and didn't want you to hear from him? What if he were actually elected president? What if we were free again? What if the whole purpose of government was to negate freedom? What if freedom was a myth? What if the Constitution meant nothing to the government? What if everything the government has or owns or controls has been stolen? What if I'm right? What if the government is wrong? What if it's dangerous to be right when the government is wrong? What's next? What if we don't know what's next? During the presidential campaign of 1980, Ronald Reagan famously asked American voters if they were better off then than they were before President Carter had been elected 4 years earlier. Voters, of course, responded overwhelmingly that they were not better off. Carter had raised taxes, increased regulations, borrowed heavily, had a meek foreign policy, and was an uninspiring leader. He had encouraged folks to wear sweaters rather than turn up the heat during the winter. He refused to permit American athletes to compete in the 1980 Summer Olympics because the old Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan. Remember that? And inflation was out of control. Reagan, of course, cut taxes in his first year. By 1988, most Americans could honestly say that they were better off after the Reagan years than they had been after the Carter years. Yesterday, in an interview with ABC News commentator George Stephanopoulos, President Obama was asked a variant of President Reagan's famous question. Here's how he answered.
Well, I don't think they're better off than they were 4 years ago. They're not better off than they were before Lehman's collapsed, before the financial crisis, before this extraordinary recession that we're going through.
What's that all about? Is the president trying to take the wind out of the sails of his critics by admitting failure before he is accused of it? Is he trying to change people's minds by changing the subject? Does he even know what he's doing? Barack Obama is the most faithful disciple of FDR that has ever occupied the White House. He truly believes that he is the smartest person in the room, that he knows how you should live your life better than you do, and he is willing to use the power of government to bend your behavior to his will. He has signed legislation into law that will permit bureaucrats to regulate the financial services industry in such a way as to remove your freedom to spend, save, and invest your own money as you wish. He has signed legislation into law that will regulate the healthcare industry by forcing you to purchase a product that you might not want, perhaps can't afford, from a company you never heard of, as a condition of living in the United States, and that will expose your private medical records to government bureaucrats whenever they want to see them. He has borrowed more money in his 2.5 years in office than any other president has in 8 years in office, nearly $6 trillion. Under his watch, the cost of corn, cotton, and gasoline have shot up by more than 25%. Under his watch, 1 in 7 Americans is receiving food stamps from the federal government. During his watch, half of all Americans receive some sort of financial assistance from some government. Under his watch, half of all Americans pay no taxes. He has mastered the art of taking wealth from those who work and giving it to his wealthy business, banking, and labor union friends to support their industries. Under his watch, 15 million Americans are looking for jobs every day. Now, this is not to suggest that he inherited an economy that was all wine and roses, but it is to argue that his rigid big government ideology, his disdain for the free market, and his mistrust for your right to make free choices has made the economy and thus your freedom far worse today than it was when he became president. When the government borrows against the future, it drives up prices, so everything costs more. And after you buy what you need, you have far less money remaining. And he has thumbed his nose at the Constitution, which he took an oath to uphold. When he starts a war without seeking a declaration of war from Congress, as the Constitution requires, he sets himself up above the law. And when he becomes judge, jury, and executioner of an American in a foreign country, in defiance of the Constitution and federal law, can we expect that the government killing of Americans in America can be far behind? Is it any wonder that his candor reveals an unhappy truth? Only he is better off than 4 years ago. When the colonists first won their independence from England, they threw off the shackles of government regulation from 3,000 miles away and traded it in for government regulation at home. Soon, each of the colonies would replace the British Parliament's laws with their own tariffs and taxes and regulations. But at the very end of the Revolution, right before local regulations were enacted, the market here was truly free. What is a free market? A free market is a system of exchange of goods and services that is free from government intervention or interference. The big government types and both parties here have often contended that the free markets have failed and have actually caused the recession from which we're all suffering today. This argument, of course, is ridiculous and born of ignorance. The federal government enacted laws that encouraged banks to lend where they ordinarily would not, and in some cases forced them to do so. When that didn't work to the satisfaction of the bureaucrats, they used taxpayer dollars to get the banks to lend to those who were not creditworthy. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, those two behemoth corporations owned by the taxpayers, effectively told the banks to lend to whomever they could because home ownership was good for everybody, and then sell the debt to Fannie and Freddie. That would be you, the taxpayers. So uncreditworthy borrowers received loans from banks and bought houses. The banks made money on each loan. The federal government bought the loans from the banks. The banks were off the hook. The borrowers defaulted. And the taxpayers got stuck with the losses. You'd be hard-pressed to find any industry or business in America that is not regulated by the federal government. We don't have free markets in the United States, but we do have capitalism. The free market and capitalism are not the same thing. Capitalism is the private ownership of the means of production and the use of such to turn a profit. A free market operates under capitalist principles, but capitalism does not necessarily require, or as we know, even prefer, a truly free market. There are all kinds of capitalism that don't rely on a free market. Crony capitalism, also known as corporatism, is a form of capitalism where the government favors certain owners of the means of production over other owners, and certain industries are assisted by the government to the detriment of others. Enter the principle of debt. Economists as different as Karl Marx and Friedrich von Hayek warned that debt would crush capitalism. Marx wanted debt to be controlled and regulated by the government. Hayek wanted debt to be regulated by the free market. In the land of the free, we have rejected Hayek's free market values from Marx's government-dominated values. Marx and Hayek actually predicted the multi-trillion dollar debts the Western world is now buckling under because they saw that eventually capitalism that relied on the government and not on the free market would create the conditions where debt is necessary to sustain an illusion of growth. Marx's solution was total government control. Hayek's solution was total freedom from the government. The miracle of a free market is that it sets prices not based on government command or the illusion that central planners and the government can know everything and make perfect decisions, but on actual supply and demand. A free market utilizes the information that each participant within the market has in order to make decisions that are best for that participant. Stated differently, you know when something is a bargain, or you know when something costs you too much, and you can freely decide whether and when to purchase it, except when the government forces you to do so. Well, how can the government force you to buy something? Take the case of Solyndra. Certainly it fit the definition of a capitalist venture. It was a private means of production of solar panels that was attempting to turn a profit. But it was also crony capitalism. And so the capital available to Solyndra was not based on economic risk or reward, but on political calculations. By using your tax dollars to help finance Solyndra, the Obama administration forced you to buy Solyndra stock. You were not free to say yes or no. And now we're all a half billion dollars poorer because of it. And that's just the one case of Solyndra. There are hundreds of others in which the government's Marx-inspired central planners have made decisions on how to spend your money, not based on free market principles, but on pure politics. What will save us from this economic catastrophe is a return to free market principles, and almost as importantly, a realization that the economic mess we are in today is not due to the free market, but due, in fact, to the absence of it. When we were colonists and were governed by the British King and Parliament, they devised ingenious means to tax us. One of the most hateful was the Stamp Act. It required that every person in the colonies buy a stamp that bore the image of the king and affix that stamp to every piece of paper in his possession. Question: how did the king know if every colonist was complying with the Stamp Act? Answer: the Townshend Act. This abominable law authorized British soldiers to write their own search warrants. Thus, British soldiers knocked on the doors of the colonists' homes and handed them warrants in which they had authorized themselves to enter, ostensibly to look for the stamps. They entered wherever they wanted, and they took whatever they wished. The colonists were so outraged at these self-written search warrants that Parliament actually rescinded the laws that permitted them. But the offenses to personal dignity and the assaults on private property were too deep. We fought a bloody revolution against the government that did this to us. After we won that revolution, we wrote a constitution to assure that these abuses would not happen again. And to that constitution, we added a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights guaranteed that the government could not on its own assault your natural rights. Among them, that quintessentially American right, the right to be left alone. Today we call this right the right to privacy. The Fourth Amendment requires that the government, before the government can assault your right to privacy and search your possessions, come onto your property, listen to your phone calls, read your mail, monitor your keystrokes on your computer, or even obtain records about you from other sources like doctors, banks, or lawyers. It must present evidence of criminal behavior on your part, under oath, to a judge. And only if the judge accepts that evidence, and only if the judge issues a search warrant, may the government legally seek and seize whatever is specifically described in the warrant. No more government knocking on doors in the middle of the night and taking whatever it wished. Regrettably, the federal government has labored mightily to get around all this. Even though every person who works for the government has taken an oath to uphold the Constitution, many of them seem to spend more time avoiding and evading it. In the days after 9/11, Congress enacted the Patriot Act, an abominable piece of legislation which permits federal agents to write their own search warrants. With the Patriot Act, we have come full circle from the days in which a king unleashed soldiers upon us on their own to the present day in which our elected representatives have unleashed federal agents upon us on their own, all in utter disregard for our natural right to be left alone and the constitutional requirements of a judicially issued search warrant. The Patriot Act, perpetrated by a Republican president and Congress, was and is one of the gravest legislative assaults on human freedom. It was harshly criticized at the time by a young Democratic senator from Illinois named Barack Obama. But freedom must look very different from inside the White House than from outside. This morning, we learned from the front page of the Wall Street Journal that the Obama Justice Department, without obtaining search warrants, has been using a computer program called Stingray, which manipulates your cell phone to enable the government to follow you whenever the phone is with you. And last month, the Obama Justice Department told the Supreme Court that it has been installing GPS systems on the cars of those without cell phones so it can follow them. And last spring, the Obama Justice Department persuaded the court to let cops break down doors without a search warrant on the basis of what they think they smell from coming behind the doors. And somehow it claims that the Fourth Amendment is no obstacle to all this. What's going on here? Is this really America in 2011, or is it East Germany in 1961? Would the government prefer to watch all of us, to seize our computer records, to listen to our conversations, to break down our doors whenever it wished, without following the Constitution? Yes, it would. Power by nature expands. That's why we have a Constitution, to restrain governmental power. Who would want to live in a society where the government was unrestrained? Have we fought wars against totalitarian governments only to find that we have elected one here at home? Did you even know that the federal government may be using your cell phone to follow you wherever you go? Have we become a nation of sheep? Sadly, the answers to these questions are obvious. During the past week, two questions have animated the political class and frustrated the big government crowd. Each question addresses sacred cows in America. Texas Governor Rick Perry caused a firestorm among the big government crowd when he called Social Security a Ponzi scheme. I hope he doesn't back down from this, because he's right. It was a scam from its inception, and it's a scam still today. When Social Security was established in 1935, it was intended as minimal financial assistance to those too old to work. It was also intended to have voters dependent on FDR's Democrats. FDR copied the idea from a system established in Italy by Mussolini. The plan was to have folks make small contributions to a fund which would be held in trust for them by the government. At the time, the average life expectancy of an American was 61 years, but Social Security didn't kick in until age 65. Thus, the system was geared, it was intended, to take money from the average American that he would never see. Exempted from these contributions were railroad workers, most of whom at the time were black, farmers who received subsidies from the feds already, and members of Congress who liked to collect taxes but not pay them. Over time, life expectancy increased. The trust fund was raided and spent, and the system was paying out more money than it was taking in. This morning on Fox, FDR's grandson called Social Security an insurance policy. He was wrong. In reality, it is forced savings, in which the custodian of the saved funds, the Congress, stole the savings. The money was stolen by inflation and by outright theft. Today, the best one can hope for is to receive 75 cents back for every dollar contributed. Social Security is actually worse than a Ponzi scheme, because you can get out of a Ponzi investment. You can't get out of Social Security. Who would stay with a bank that only returned 75% of one's savings? Because all the money that goes out comes directly from all the money coming in. This is a classic Ponzi scheme. Now, I never heard Governor Perry say that those who have contributed money should not get back what they've contributed. But I did hear him say that the Constitution does not permit the feds to take your money and then steal it. And he's right. Also this week, a young man from Napa, California, asked Wolf Blitzer to pose the following question to the Republican candidates for president during their debate on CNN. If I earn a dollar, how much of it am I entitled to keep? The question was passed to former Utah Governor John Huntsman, who punted. I'll answer the young man's question. All of it. At the beginning of each of these closing arguments every night on Freedom Watch, I ask, does the government work for us, or do we work for the government? Every official government pronouncement, from the Declaration of Independence to the United States Constitution to the oaths that everyone who works for the government publicly takes, indicates that the government exists to work for us. They also state that the government receives all of its powers from the consent of the governed. If you believe all of this, as I do, then just as we don't have the power to take our neighbor's property and distribute it against his will, we lack the ability to give that power to the government. Stated differently, just as you lack the moral and legal authority to take my property, you cannot authorize the government to do so. Here's an example you've heard from me before. You're sitting at home at night. There's a knock at the door. You open the door, and a guy with a gun pointed at you says, "Give me your money. I want to give it away to the less fortunate." You think this guy's dangerous and he's crazy, so you call the police. Then you find out he is the police, there to collect your taxes. The framers of the Constitution understood this. For 150 years, the federal government was financed by user fees and the sale of government land and assessments to the states for services that the feds rendered to them. This worked perfectly well until the progressives took over the government in the early 20th century. The imposition of the federal income tax is more than just a spigot to fill the federal trough. It presumes that we don't really own our property. It accepts the Marxist notion that the state owns all property and permits us to keep whatever it needs us to have so we won't riot in the streets, and then it keeps whatever it can get away with. Look, there are only three ways to wealth in a free society. The inheritance model occurs when someone dies and leaves you wealth. The economic model occurs when you trade a skill, a talent, knowledge, sweat, energy, or creativity to a willing buyer. And the mafia model occurs when a guy with a gun says, "Give me your money or else." Which model does the government use? The Constitution grants to Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce. When that phrase was written in 1787, it meant that the new federal government would be authorized to keep commerce moving regularly between the states. The states, which had just won their independence from the King of England, fell under the influence of wealthy merchants and bankers, the same merchants and bankers who had loaned the states the money with which to support the armies that fought against the king. The merchants and bankers were also in control of the state legislatures, so they were both creditors and debtors. They ran the governments that owed the money to them. So they did what you might expect them to do. They made competition difficult, and they imposed tariffs on out-of-state goods. These tariffs, of course, made it impossible to sell a product across state lines because of the cost to the consumer. And like tariffs always do, they raised prices on everything. Hence, the Commerce Clause was written so that Congress would keep commerce regular, moving freely, and without interference by the government, state or federal. Unfortunately, as we all know, we moved from commerce controlled by the states to commerce controlled by the feds. From the very beginning, Congress exceeded its charge of keeping commerce regular and began to control prices, conditions of travel, wages of those who made the items that moved in interstate commerce. And last year, as we all know, it tried to control health care. But Obamacare did more than regulate the insurance industry and more than force the states to expand Medicaid and more than expand Medicare. It contains what lawyers call the individual mandate. That's the clause of the law that forces every person in America to purchase health insurance from a private insurer. Not from the government, but from a private health insurance company. Thus, the question for the courts has been, does the Commerce Clause, the one that requires Congress to keep commerce regular, permit Congress to compel you to buy something you might not want or think you don't need or at the moment can't afford? Can Congress make you wear a hat in the sun? Can it make you eat broccoli at dinner? Well, 16 lawsuits have been filed in various federal trial courts around the country, and five have been ruled upon by trial judges, and two of those have made it to the United States Courts of Appeal. Last month, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit in Cincinnati said that Congress can do this. It can make you buy health insurance. Last Friday, the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit in Atlanta said Congress cannot. The Federal Circuit Courts of Appeal are the last stop before the Supreme Court. And when they differ on a matter of great importance for the public, this isn't a dispute between two people at a traffic intersection, the Supreme Court knows it is time to step in. So we now know that because President Obama and the Democratic Congress have forced this individual mandate upon us, its fate will be decided by 9 life tenure justices and not by our elected representatives. All because the people we send to the federal government, each of whom has sworn a solemn oath to uphold the Constitution, simply don't give a damn about it. So which do you want? A Congress that does whatever it thinks it can do to keep itself in power? A Congress that bribes the people with their own tax dollars? Or one that follows the Constitution its members have sworn to uphold? The answer is obvious. Whatever happened to the Constitution? During the past 4 months, we have seen the breakdown of government as we have known it in America. In June, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that police officers may lawfully break down the door of an apartment or home on the basis of what they or their dogs are smelling from inside the home. This is the same excuse for breaking down doors that governments in Eastern Europe used for generations, and we fought a cold war against them for doing so. It might happen to your neighbor, it might happen to your children, it might not ever happen to anyone you know. But who would want to live in a society where that can happen? Sadly, we all live in such a place. It is here. In April of this year, while the Congress was on its spring break, President Obama announced that he was bombing military targets in Libya in order to prevent a humanitarian disaster. He claimed that our troops were not engaging in hostilities or war because none of them have been killed and because all of their killing is being done from the air and not from the ground. He said that it would be over in weeks, not months. It is now August. The United States military is still there. The killings from the sky have continued. Congress has behaved like a potted plant and has done nothing to curtail this, even though under the Constitution, only Congress can start wars. Yesterday, while the Congress was on its summer break, President Obama announced that he will decide in which states an ill-advised and no doubt unconstitutional Bush-era law called No Child Left Behind will be enforced and in which states it will not. He has no such power under the Constitution. Think about it. How can your federal rights and benefits be enhanced or degraded by where you live and at the whim of the president? Last week, the Congress, after months of wrangling over the government's debt, agreed to permit the president to borrow another $2.4 trillion, but decided not to decide what strings should be attached to it. Instead, the Congress delegated away its powers to a super Congress that will deliberate in secret and send recommendations back to the real Congress. And that Congress, without any debate or amendments, will simply vote yes or no. As a result of this crazy move, the stock market has nearly crashed. It has lost 15% of its net worth off its highest value this year. And the government's credit score has gone south. What the heck is going on here? Does anyone remember the Constitution? The police can only search and seize a home when a judge, not their noses or their dogs, authorize them to do so. The president is supposed to enforce all the laws equally and upon everyone, not subjectively and against his enemies or for his friends or for his political needs. And the Congress is supposed to deliberate on everything in public, with robust debate amongst all 535 members so that we know what they've said and what they're doing. Not just 12 of them in secret. And how can a problem caused by too much borrowing and spending possibly be cured by more borrowing and spending? The Constitution is the supreme law of the land. It is the baseline for all governmental behavior. Its guarantees must be honored or they are worthless, and its protections must be afforded, and its procedures must be followed, or we will have no law. And where there is no law, there will be chaos. America, I am sorry to say, chaos is coming. As I speak, there is chaos in England, in Ireland, in Portugal, in Spain, in Italy, and in Greece. There is chaos here in our stock market. There is chaos here in our economy. There is chaos here in our culture. There is chaos here in the federal government. The chaos is because the people we have sent to the government have ignored the supreme law of the land. Instead of following the Constitution, they have attempted to change it. Instead of long-term values, they have opted for short-term gain and quick fixes. Instead of openness, they have given us secrecy. If the Constitution means what it says, it compels freedom and openness and restrains the government and compels it to obey its own laws. If its provisions are not upheld when they pinch as well as when they comfort, what is the sense of having a constitution in the first place? The story of money is part of the long history of civilization. It has been recorded on slabs and stones, on walls and monuments, in tombs and Bibles and on manuscripts. The mysterious history of money is a legacy inspired by progress and industry, capitalism and freedom, wealth and civilization. It has also been inspired by theft and death, by totalitarianism and government demands, by weakness and government force. So how does a civilized and free nation conduct its monetary policy? First, a little history. Before Benjamin Franklin was considered by King George III to be a traitorous rebel, he was first a diplomat sent to the British king to engage in negotiations aimed at avoiding the pending American Revolution. At a dinner party one night in London, Franklin was asked to give a small talk about the American colonies across the ocean. Thinking about what would impact the British the most, Franklin told them, "Well, you can leave your ship with just your baggage, walk beyond the furthest homestead, and become an immediate landowner." His dinner companions couldn't believe him. "You mean," they asked, "you don't need the permission of the government or a loan from the government's bank to own property in the colonies across the sea?" When they finally quieted down, Franklin told them a shocking truth. "It's quite simple. We have created our own currency." Well, who were these colonists to create their own currency? How could a currency possibly sustain prosperity without a central bank to control it? Who were these colonists to own property without the government's approval or the involvement of the government's bank? The British Parliament almost immediately outlawed colonial scrip. The scrip were printed demand notes that represented gold stored in banks and homes. They weren't the worthless Federal Reserve notes that we have today. They were real money created by merchants and bankers and the colonial governments. Franklin brought the unhappy news with him back to Philadelphia. Later, he would be known to say, "You know, we would gladly have borne the little tax on tea and other matters had it not been they took from us our money, which, when they took it, created great unemployment and dissatisfaction within a year. The poorhouses were filled. The hungry and the homeless walked the streets everywhere." While the phrase "taxation without representation is tyranny" may have been the colonists' battle cry, as much suffering was visited upon the colonists by the Bank of England as was done by the King of England. So you see, one of the founders of the United States of America had no difficulty whatsoever identifying the root cause of misery in the colonies: central banks controlling money. But Americans today know precious little about money and how it is used against us. You hear me speak often on Freedom Watch about debt and taxes, about gold and the Federal Reserve. Here's a little Economics 101. The topics dealing with issues of taxing and spending are what's known as fiscal policy. And the topics dealing with issues of inflation, the Fed, and the creation of money itself are what's known as monetary policy. Monetary policy is about how money is created, and fiscal policy is where it's destroyed by the government. It's not enough that Congress and the government destroy the fruits of our labors and consume them with wasteful spending and thieving taxation, but the manner in which money is created by the Federal Reserve out of thin air, with no gold or anything of value to back it, is abhorrent, immoral, unconstitutional, and quite simply, un-American. If you or I printed cash in our basements and used it in voluntary transactions, we'd go to jail. The Constitution says that only Congress can coin money and set its value. So how did this private bank get to print our money? The government gets its powers from the consent of the governed. We didn't give that power to a private bank. In America today, we have a private central bank with the monopoly power of printing money. It is an unelected, secretive, and dangerous institution that manipulates the economy by destroying the purchasing power of those who work and save and transferring it to those who kill and steal, tax and destroy. What is it? You know, it's the Federal Reserve. Twice before, we had national banks that were abolished by Congress. But the creature from Jekyll Island, that's the place off the coast of Georgia where the Federal Reserve was hatched, lives on today, risen from the grave, and now intent on devaluing our future and keeping Americans in the dark about the truth of where their money comes from. Don't let any fancy talk from the New York Times or the liberal media or Treasury Secretary Geithner fool you. the federal government, that would be you and me, the American taxpayer, borrows money from the Federal Reserve and must repay that money with interest. Before the Fed existed, the Treasury directly circulated currency backed by gold. Since the Fed, we pay interest just to have the money. We effectively rent our money from the Federal Reserve, and our money is just worthless pieces of paper. Does it make any sense that if we can't pay our bills with the money we have already rented from the Fed, that we should rent more money from the Fed? Of course not. But that's just what the president wants to do by raising the debt ceiling. If the American people ever wish to regain control of the government, we need to understand the monetary system, and we need to alter materially the banking system so as to replace our debt-based, money-out-of-thin-air economy with an economy based on production, on savings, on capitalism, and on competition. Only then can true prosperity return. Boy, if we ever get to audit the Fed and its money lenders, the demand to end the Fed will become overwhelming. The problem, America, is a simple one, but the solution requires political courage. Since the presidency of Woodrow Wilson, the federal government has always spent more money than it has collected in taxes. The additional money has been provided by borrowing. When the borrowed money has become due, the government has simply borrowed more money, often at higher interest rates, and used the newly borrowed money to pay back the lenders who came calling. Any high school student capable of understanding basic math knows that this simply cannot last. At some point, the debt is so great that the interest payments become unbearable. That point is today. Today, the debt that the federal government owes, that your federal government owes, is $14.3 trillion. And the annual interest payments on that debt are about $440 billion. Where does the government get that $440 billion? It borrows it. The government is so addicted to debt that it has become the source for about 40% of all the bills the federal government pays. In some months, the feds actually borrow more money than they collect in taxes. And as we know, it saves nothing. Every dollar it can get its hands on, it spends. To make this even less transparent, the government has created its own bank and authorized that bank to print cash and then lend that printed cash to the government. This is the functional equivalent of counterfeiting. And anyone who thinks that this can continue without adverse consequences is willfully ignorant of basic economics. Think about it. If printing cash produced prosperity, then we'd all be rich. Instead, the government's now 100-year-old failed experiment of printing cash has burdened each person in America with a debt of over $44,000. In the last 2 years, the government's bank that counterfeits all this cash, the Federal Reserve, has done so to the tune of nearly $1.6 trillion. This $1.6 trillion is included in the $14.3 trillion national debt that the federal government is obligated to pay. But wait a minute. If the federal government owes the Federal Reserve $1.6 trillion, doesn't that mean that the government, in a sense, owes $1.6 trillion to itself? This is an issue that the Fed will never want to confront. Is the Federal Reserve a government institution or is it a private bank? One way to burst that bubble and answer that question would be for the federal government simply to cancel its obligations to the Federal Reserve. In fact, Texas Republican Congressman Ron Paul suggested just last week that the federal government simply default on its payments to the Federal Reserve. No one would lose a nickel if we owe the money to ourselves. If the government were to wipe out its debt to the Federal Reserve, then investors might actually feel confident that the government could meet its legitimate obligations to legitimate lenders rather than to its own bank that counterfeits its own cash. What would the Fed do if the government stopped paying it for its counterfeit cash? It would claim that it is a private bank. It would deny that it is a government institution. It would sue the federal government. And ultimately, the Supreme Court would decide if this 100-year-old printing press experiment is constitutional, moral in the first place. And then we will see that the emperor has had no clothes. Texas Congressman Louie Gohmert offered a flattering insight into Washington last week when he remarked that by Freedom Watch addressing this issue with conservatives and libertarians in Congress, the show has been strengthening the backbones of those on Capitol Hill who've become wobbly. Republicans must resist the fear-mongering, the Obama administration's shills and its lies and its attempts to cajole them into borrowing more money. some establishment GOP members are openly signaling their willingness for a compromise with the vague reference to the idea that there must be significant cuts in spending. What they don't tell you is that significant cuts means reductions in increases in spending, not cuts in actual spending. It's a trick. Don't be fooled. History will judge the Republicans in Congress by the actions they take in the next few weeks. This may be the last best hope to rein in a monster federal government by forcing it to live within its means. If Republicans muster the courage to do this, if they stop the federal government from borrowing now, the voters will reward them with victory, and the economy will reward all of us with prosperity. On the other hand, if the Republicans let the government continue its 100-year failing experiment, they will be relegated to the dustbin of history. The doctrine of natural rights was most prominently laid out by Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence right at the beginning of the document. "We hold these truths to be self-evident," he wrote, "that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." This is probably the most famous phrase in the English language. But the words that immediately follow may be the most important. Here's what it says. "To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." Okay, what is the consent of the governed? Natural rights are inherent to your humanity and the source of your sovereignty as a free individual. If you believe in God as I do and Jefferson did, then you accept the truism that we have been created by him in his image and likeness, and just as he is perfectly free, so are we. If you believe instead that we are the product of natural evolutionary forces and not the intentional recipients of gifts from a loving supreme being, you also recognize that we own our minds and our bodies and we have the free will to use them as we see fit. Either way, whether you choose theology or biology as the source of our rights, the birth of America in the Declaration of Independence recognized that our rights come from within us. They are not given to us by the government. You have a right to your person, to your property, and to your version of the pursuit of happiness. You also have the right to think as you wish, to say what you think, and to publish what you say. You have the right to use violence to protect yourself from anyone or anything trying to take away your rights. You have the right to privacy, to fairness from the government, the right to travel, to worship or not to worship. You have the right to keep and enjoy your earnings and your property, and you have the right to be left alone. All humans have these rights. But sometimes bad and power-hungry people will try to take these rights away. A thief in the night will use a gun or a crowbar to steal your car. A thief in the government will use the law to steal your income. You get the picture. And the Declaration of Independence talks about government receiving its just powers from the consent of the governed. It is describing the process by which we transfer a portion of our natural rights to the government, the process by which we each give away some of our freedom, some of our individual sovereignty, and thus give to the government its authority to govern. What's important to note about this process is that according to the Declaration of Independence, it is supposed to be voluntary and consensual. That's why government can only wield those powers which the individual is at liberty to wield and to give to the government. Think of it this way. You can't steal a car from your neighbor, and so your friends can't hire an agent to go out and steal from your neighbor either. And thus, you and your friends cannot empower the government to do the stealing. Again, I think you get the point. Lawful government only has the powers that we once had and we lawfully gave to the government. Just as slaves had the moral and legal right to leave those enslaving them, just as the states have the moral and legal right to leave a union that violates the Constitution that binds them, so too you have the moral right to live without a government when it breaks its own laws. The federal government claims your consent through the Constitution. The Constitution is a social contract that binds the American people to their government. Did you freely consent to this? I don't know anybody who did. So since none of us consented to the Constitution, either the government stays within the confines of the Constitution, or we can ignore or change the government. This view, called the consent of the governed, was widely and openly accepted by the framers. They gave us a constitution which defines limits and constrains the government. This is why adherence to the constitution by all government is so crucial to preserving and retaining our freedoms. The constitution formalizes the relationship between sovereign people and sovereign states and the federal government. When the Constitution is ignored, so is our sovereignty. And if we can't avoid a government to which we never gave consent and which violates the Constitution's, so will our freedoms be ignored. Over the weekend, the FBI announced that it was granting itself new powers to investigate us. Now I should stop right here and ask what the heck is going on. How can the FBI possibly grant itself new powers? The short answer is, legally, it can't. It can try new assaults on our constitutionally guaranteed freedoms and see if the courts accept them. Yet the powers that the FBI says it is granting to itself are actually add-ons to other powers that Congress has given the FBI in the past 40 years. First, a little background. For 50 years, the job of the FBI had been to investigate crimes that already happened and to assist federal prosecutors in presenting cases to federal juries. Under its legendary but authoritarian director, J. Edgar Hoover, the Bureau acquired the reputation as the best law enforcement agency in the country, bar none. It showed the most respect for the Constitution. Its agents were the best educated and trained. Many state and local police yearned to join the Bureau. It solved the most notorious crimes in the nation, from the Roaring Twenties to the Clinton era. But a series of unfortunate and tragic events took their toll on its behavior and our freedom. After President Nixon left office, we learned that he, just like JFK and LBJ before him, had used the FBI to dig up dirt on political adversaries. He did so claiming that national security was at stake, and he claimed that, quote, if the president does it, it's not illegal. Well, in response to that, Congress enacted legislation that gave the FBI authority to obtain search warrants from a secret court only when it was investigating agents of foreign powers, matters of national security, but underscored that this could not be used on Americans. Then in the Reagan years, the Congress decided that it wanted the FBI to be able to examine the bank accounts of drug dealers and mobsters with a little bit more ease, so it permitted the FBI to go directly to banks and ask them for records of certain depositors. Whatever the banks turned over could not be used by prosecutors unless the person of whom they were records volunteered that information to the FBI. Then we were attacked on 9/11, and the Congress enacted the Patriot Act. This law, which changes the focus of the FBI from investigating crime to anticipating crime, has been found unconstitutional by five different federal judges, but was recently reenacted by the Congress. It permits federal agents from the FBI to the TSA to write their own search warrants. It was intended to let agents cut corners of the Constitution, just like British soldiers did when the king allowed them to write their own search warrants so they could rummage through the colonists' homes looking for personal property to tax. But even FBI self-written search warrants were supposed to be served only on financial institutions and were limited only to investigations of terrorism, and then only when a legitimate investigation was ongoing. Then Congress changed the definition of financial institution to include everything from your computer server to your doctor to your mailman. Then FBI agents began writing their own search warrants for any crimes they were investigating, whether it involved terrorism or not. You get the picture. That brings us to this past weekend, when the FBI announced that henceforth it would permit its agents on their own to follow and snoop on anybody they wanted, whether there was any suspicion of criminal activity about that person or not. It would permit its agents to sort through the garbage of anyone they chose, whether there was any suspicious behavior on the part of whoever used the garbage or not. And it would allow searches of any databases that the FBI felt like searching about anyone in whom it was interested, whether there was criminal suspicion about that person or not. Have they forgotten that their job is to protect our freedom as well as our safety? Whatever happened to the constitutional guarantees of privacy? Think about it. What cop or FBI agent would bother going to a judge for a search warrant if they could just write their own? Oh, and last month, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that cops and federal agents can break into your house without a warrant if they smell from outside the house what they think are drugs. This must have sent a signal to the FBI that it could get away with cutting more holes in the Constitution. We live in scary times, America. Of course, it would be easier for the FBI if they broke down whatever door they pleased, read whatever email they wished, arrested whomever they wanted, and waterboarded the arrested person until he told them what they wanted to hear. But who would want to live in such an America? Sadly, we might all find out soon. The Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman often used the post office as the very symbol of government inefficiency. His one-liner usually went like this. The government can't deliver the mail, and you expect it to provide or regulate? And here you'd fill in the blank. The blank was often the point he wanted to make. You've heard me on Freedom Watch fill in that blank with everything from Obamacare to school lunches. But the interesting part of that phrase is the first part, and that's the part that no one ever really disputes. The government can't deliver the mail. Why can't the government deliver the mail? First, a little constitutional law, and then a little history. The Constitution specifically authorizes the Congress to establish the post office. So while it's not unconstitutional, it is still grossly inefficient. My own view is that there are parts of the Constitution that are itself unconstitutional. But the post office is not one of them, and that's another argument for another time. The post office grew and prospered as the nation did, and for generations it was the principal means of communicating with anyone other than having a direct conversation. For many years, the post office was self-sustaining, and for many years it actually made money. The cost of the stamps once paid for the delivery of all the mail and all the overhead. In the 1840s, the cost of mailing a letter was determined by weight and distance. An average one-ounce letter cost 14.5 cents. To mail from New York to Boston, and in 1841, it took 5 days to get there. Then a man named Lysander Spooner started a business to compete with the post office. He charged lower rates, he delivered in less time, and he brought the mail directly to your home, not just to the post office in your town. Not to be outdone, the post office kept lowering its charge for stamps. By 1851, both Spooner's company and the government were charging 3 cents to deliver that same one-ounce letter from Boston to New York. And so the federal government, unaccustomed to competition, sued Spooner and his company and tried to get a jury to put him out of business. The jury loved what Spooner did. He made life better and cheaper. The feds lost. And then they did what they always do when they have competition they can't tolerate. They outlawed it. So in 1851, the feds were losing money by delivering mail from post office to post office. Spooner was making money by delivering mail from post office to private homes and businesses. And Congress thought it could make the post office solvent by banning the competition from charging less than the post office charged. The 3 cent stamp stayed in place for over 100 years, with Congress using tax dollars to fill in the deficits in the post office's budget. After 1913, things started to get worse for the post office, but better for Congress. That's when Congress got more money from the brand new income tax with which to plug the holes in the budget of the post office. But that's when the Federal Reserve started to devalue the dollar and the post office needed more and more money. Since the 1960s, the price of a stamp has gone up from 5 cents to 44 cents. The service is worse. The bureaucracy has grown and price competition is still illegal. Here's the point. Yesterday, the post office revealed that it has used a line of credit that Congress has given it to the tune of $2 billion in just the first 3 months of this year. Its total line of credit is $15 billion. And yesterday as well, the post office revealed that it's likely to hit that number this September. Just like its sugar daddy, the Congress, the post office has never paid down its loans, and it just keeps borrowing. Just like anything the government owns, it doesn't produce wealth, it just consumes it. So why do we still have this Soviet-style behemoth on our books? The answer is always the same. Votes. The post office employs over 300,000 people and they vote. I once personally suggested to President Reagan that he sell the post office. He answered very amiably, as he always did, and then one of his aides took me aside and said, Uncle Ronnie had no stomach for a fight with the postal unions. Okay, so you have an important letter, a document that needs to get today from New York to Boston, or a mortgage check that must get to the bank in 2 days. Are you going to use the post office? Of course not. You'll use UPS or FedEx or any of the profitable private carriers who, like Mr. Spooner's company, will guarantee delivery on time. Those folks would be the folks who'd put the post office out of business overnight if the laws permitted fair competition. What shall we do? Sell the post office tomorrow. Stop the drain on tax dollars. Move into the 21st century with the delivery of mail. Let competition improve the product. But don't hold your breath. The only thing the politicians like more than giving away your money is keeping their jobs, no matter the cost to you. Selling a dinosaur makes just too much sense to that crowd that thinks it can print cash and borrow its way to prosperity. In September 2008, right before then-Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson persuaded then-President George W. Bush that the sky was falling and that it was the fault of the mortgage companies and only huge loans from the government to those companies would prevent an economic crisis, the debt of the federal government was around $9 trillion. Today, that debt is around $14.3 trillion, an increase of nearly 50% in just 2.5 years. In September 2008, there were 31 million Americans on food stamps. Today, there are 44 million Americans on food stamps, an increase of nearly 50% in 2.5 years. In September 2008, gasoline prices averaged about $1.75 a gallon. Today, they average over $4 a gallon, an increase of over 150% in 2.5 years. Since 2008, the total value of all Americans' homes, the principal investment for most of us, has gone down by an aggregate of around $6 trillion, and over 3 million homes have been lost to foreclosures. And last month, the Treasury reported that 43% of Americans received some form of financial benefit from the federal government. And if you add to this the salaries and benefits and wealth transfers paid by state and local governments, the percentage of Americans dependent on the government approaches 50. That's one half of the country working to support the other half. These are, of course, statistics, and they are subject to interpretive analysis. And where you stand sometimes depends on where you sit. If you're sitting as an academic with tenure, as a government employee with no competition, or as a union member with benefits guaranteed for life, little of this bothers you. And if you sit dependent on the government, or if you sell products to the government, little of this will disturb you. But remember what government is. It consists of the lawful use of force for the good of those in power. And today, those in power, and for the most part, those who have been in power since the beginning of the New Deal, have used the government's monopoly on force to take liberty, to steal property, and to compel behavior that suits their needs, all the while claiming that we are better off for it. In 2008, when banks made bad business decisions, instead of the banks suffering the natural consequences of those decisions, the federal government bailed them out, and we all suffered the consequences. Former President Bush recently acknowledged that the stimulus packages that he signed into law were inconsistent with his beliefs in the free market and were the opposite of what he told the voters he would do. Is that what we get from an oath to uphold the Constitution? Remember TARP and the Bush administration borrowing from foreign governments? Remember the $1,600 per family they gave away one summer? Remember how it was sold to us as a cure for our economic woes? The joke was that the feds borrowed money from India so they could give cash away to Americans who would buy flat-screen TVs made in China. This boondoggle and TARP cost you and your children $1 trillion in the last year of President Bush's administration. Not to be outdone, President Obama borrowed and gave away over $2 trillion in the first year of his administration. These days, he borrows $1.5 trillion a year just to help him run the government. What is the lesson here? It is that all this borrowing by the government, none of which is paid back except by more borrowing, has not led to prosperity. It has just led to economic control. The government has access to the same statistics as do the rest of us. You'd think the feds would learn that since the final year of the presidency of George W. Bush and into the presidency of Barack Obama, debt is deeper, foreclosures are greater, dependency on the government is broader, inflation is higher, unemployment is static, and now it costs you about $70 to fill the tank of your car. Why have prices gone up and packages of goods become smaller? Because the dollar buys less today than it did in September 2008. And why is that? Because the government has borrowed from the Federal Reserve, which has created money out of thin air and thus devalued all the dollars already in circulation. What is the answer? Oh, the big government types in both parties want more of the same. More borrowing and spending, more debt and regulation, more dependency on the government, more control by it. But those who love this country and love freedom, know that first principles will save us. The government must reside within the confines of the Constitution. Its borrowing has nearly choked the economy, and it must stop now.